Our second matter on today's calendar is A18-1794, State of Minnesota versus David Barrientos. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and 5 minutes for rebuttal, as you so choose, as both of you know. And please state your name and the party you're representing when you approach the podium. With that, counsel, you may begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Workman. I'm an assistant public defender, and I represent the appellant, David Barrientos. Your Honors, the issue before this court this morning is whether police had probable cause to search Mr. Barrientos' car a second time after the first search of the car revealed nothing. And the answer to that is no. This court's probable cause determination is limited to the four corners of the warrant application. In order to search Mr. Barrientos' car a second time, police had to provide new information in the warrant application that showed a change of circumstances from the first search.
Why is that, Ms. Workman, when the first search didn't require probable cause?
The first search does require probable cause.
It was based on consent.
Probable cause, though, Your Honor, and I'm not going to stand here and argue that there wasn't probable cause for the first search. The dog search requires reasonable suspicion. The first search did have probable cause.
Well, whether it did or not, though, that nobody had to make that determination. He invited the officers to search his car, and they did. So there wasn't any necessary finding of probable cause until the judge did that. With the warrant to search the car.
That's correct, Your Honor. There was a warrant to search for the second search. However, that warrant was based on deficient information.
What deficient information?
When you look at the warrant application, Your Honor, you have to look. Let's just be clear here that the Souto case makes it clear that Your Honors can only determine if there was probable cause based on the warrant application itself. So when you look at that warrant application, most of it is a cut and paste job from the prior application that they had submitted with the warrant for the pen register for the phone.
So you're talking about the two cell phone warrants.
That's correct.
And there certainly was that information, but there was new information.
There was not new information. The only...
The new information. So the first warrant was for the pen search, right?
That's right.
Okay. Did that have anything in there about the suspicion of drugs in the car?
So let me back up and explain to you what the officers needed to give in that second warrant application in order for there to be probable cause and why that's lacking here. What they needed to give was reasons why after that search, there was a change in circumstances that meant that they needed to move the car to the police department and search it there.
Well, but I'm not so sure it seems like you're moving the needle a little bit, because aren't we looking at what was in the first search?
No, Your Honor. What you're looking at...
Well, let me finish. Because when I look at the cases, the two cases that you cite that you rely on, those cases involved... An initial search warrant, and then in one case, it was actually two search warrants, and the Supreme Court said for the third search warrant, the only thing that will be allowed is a search for blood, which is different and was not in the first two search warrants.
That's true, yes.
Okay, so in this case, you had initial search warrant for the cell phones.
That's right.
Okay, and then after that warrant was issued, the police added additional information, including the dog alerting strongly twice to drugs.
Okay, so
why isn't that new information?
That's not new information to get a second search. That is information that they had.
Second search warrant, though. We're talking about search warrant if you're looking at those other two cases.
But that search, even if it's consent, that search was based on probable cause. That information from the dog search, the admission to using meth in the car earlier in the day, that's all information that they knew at the time that they first searched the car. That is not new information by the time they provide that information to the signing judge in that warrant application.
Well, it's information that was not included in the first two search warrants here.
And that, you need to put that issue aside
But isn't that what the Supreme Court looked at in the two cases that you cited?
We're not talking about whether there's, we're not comparing the search warrants here because actually they are sort of like apples and oranges. That is a search warrant for a
phone. Isn't that what the Supreme Court did in the other two cases though?
But that has nothing to do with this case here.
I agree with you on this point. So I want to stop you there if I can. So this case is different, it seems like, than the two cases that you cite, because here, as Judge Flory points out, consent was given for the first search. Are you aware of any cases, and I'm going to ask your colleague this question as well, are you aware of any cases that are on point to this case where you've got not a search warrant to search a car, but consent, and then subsequently a search warrant that's issued?
I'm not aware of that, and that's why we're here today, Your Honor, because it is a novel situation. But I can tell you that Zanter and Fort are the most opposite to this situation, and Zanter and Fort endorse that a change of circumstances has to happen.
So let me ask, if I may. I understand your argument to be, and it doesn't matter that whether or not the first search was subject to a warrant. What matters is whether probable cause exists now for
That's
this
right.
warrant.
That's right.
And probable cause is, as your own brief says, a fair probability that contraband or evidence will be found in a particular
That's
place,
right.
right? And your argument then is if the first search was exhaustive,
That's
there's
right.
no longer probable cause to find evidence in that particular place. The concern I have with your argument is that the search warrant application, in fact, identifies that roadside search may not find it, and that they wanted permission then to conduct a more detailed search. In other words, they had not committed or performed an exhaustive search, so there remained probable cause that evidence of the crime will be found in the car. That's the issue, right? And if you could focus on why that is not, it's not new evidence of that they found of the crime or anything like that, but it's saying that first search did not exhaustively search it. Therefore, there remains probable cause that evidence may be found.
So 2 points to that, and thank you for focusing in on that because that is where we're at. Yes. Regarding that very small phrase in this warrant application about the roadside search, that was a conclusory statement made by the officers with no supporting facts. They gave us no information in the application about why the roadside was so dangerous, why they couldn't perform it. And quite frankly, if it was dangerous, they wouldn't have done this search to begin with.
But isn't that possibly just self-evident that a more detailed search of a car on a roadside is not the best place to actually deconstruct a vehicle and look for evidence?
I believe Zanter and all of the warrant case law from Illinois v. Gates on tells us that police have to be very specific. They have to give us supporting facts. They can't just say, well, you know, this is how it is. And
what would they need to put here to describe something more of a more detailed search, which it said, a more detailed search of the car, that a roadside search, what they described as roadside search. What more facts did they need? Did they need to describe that a roadside search does not include deconstructing the vehicle, or what do they need?
Exactly. And maybe tell us what technology they didn't have available to them at the roadside search that they would have available to them at the police department. Tell us what other officers who may have more specialized training in these types of searches are available at the police department but are not available there for the roadside search. None of that is there in the application. But when we go to my second point here, which is why this was an exhaustive search, what you can see here is this clearly was a very thorough search. And when you review the video, it is clear as day how thorough this search was. Three officers went through this car, and it's not a big car. It doesn't take a long time to go through, but they went through for 20 minutes. They went through the entire passenger compartment. They went through the entire trunk. They lifted the hood on the car. One of the officers got down on his belly and started looking under the undercarriage of this car. So this was a very exhaustive search. Just because they're frustrated that they didn't find something does not give them permission to move the car to the police department and continue searching.
But would it have been feasible on a roadside search to, for instance, maybe take off the panels to the door on the inside or take apart portions of the car to see whether or not there are actually drugs that are stashed away somewhere, especially when the affidavit specifically highlighted that the dog sniff alerted, and not only alerted once, but alerted twice.
Inside the car.
And had a strong alert. So they had a very, very strong suspicion that something was there. Combine that with the fact that, it's probably not a good idea to start ripping apart a car on the side
of the road. If it's not feasible, then they need to put that in the warrant application. Tell the signing judge why it's not feasible.
Right. But they talk about a roadside search. I mean, it seems logical that you don't want to, I mean, officers and people get struck on roadside, when cars on the roadside, not infrequently. So, I mean, why would you want to and take that chance there?
Again, when you look at the progeny and the plethora of warrant case law out there, it is very clear how specific they need to be in their warrant applications. They can't just give a conclusory statement and hope that the signing judge knows what that means. They have to give those supporting facts in detail so that we know exactly what they meant, what they were basing this on, why they were asking for it, and the signing judge needs to know that as well.
Do you agree, Ms. Workman, that you argued that the police had probable cause to do that warrantless search at the side of the road? Do you agree that if that's the case, they could have just towed the vehicle without a warrant to the station and searched it there?
No, Your Honor. What you are referring to is a continuing probable cause type of theory, and there is no case law, federal or from Minnesota, that would endorse such a theory.
Well, but if you're acknowledging there was probable cause for the warrantless search at the roadside, it seems then the motor vehicle exception would apply, which would have allowed the vehicle to be taken to a more secure place to be searched.
The motor vehicle exception would apply if they had not conducted that first search. Then they could impound it and move it. The motor vehicle exception here is different. It's for exigent circumstances. We do not have those exigent circumstances present here because Mr. Barrientos is not in the car when the search is performed. He is secured back in the cruiser, and there's no circumstance where he might be destroying the car or driving off and fleeing in the car.
So help me out a little bit there. Maybe I misunderstood. So if there's probable cause for the initial search, and I appreciate that if he's unavailable to move the car, et cetera. Did you say, though, that this is more or less legal than just practical, that at that point, rather than conducting the roadside search, they could have, at that point, seized the car, taken it, and conducted...
Asked for a warrant at that point.
And then asked for a warrant, including to do...
That's right.
But the problem here, then, the problem in this case is that they did conduct a search.
They did a first search, and then they did a second search. And I understand
So it comes
that
down to the exhaustiveness
right,
of the first
that's
search.
That's right. And I understand that respondent has cited the Chambers case from the U.S. Supreme Court. That is quite different than the circumstances here, and the circumstances differentiate it completely. In Chambers, there was a robbery. Officers stopped the car, they arrested the individuals in the car, and then towed the car because it was dark where they stopped it to a police department and searched it there. There was no initial search at the scene, and that is what differentiates Chambers from this situation here. And also, Chambers relies upon a 1925 case that essentially establishes the automobile exception and goes through why it's the exigent circumstances in that case support that search. Again, if you look through that, that would be the Carroll case from 1925. Totally different set of circumstances than what we have here. Your Honors, I have no further points I'd like to make. Are there any other questions from the panel? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Michael Everson, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. And I'd like to pick off right where appellant counsel's argument ended, that being whether there was even a warrant needed for the second search. And the answer to that question is no, there's not. And again, the Chambers case, I think, is right on point. There's testimony at the omnibus hearing, specifically at and around pages 22, where the officer describes why he was unable to sort of do a thorough search on the roadside. He talked about how it was rush hour, how they've had issues with people driving and trying to watch what the officers are doing. He talked about how officers can't go to the undercarriage. And all of that, again, is relevant to whether the automobile exception continues to apply once the vehicle is moved to the police station. Now, counsel did talk about the exigency no longer exists once the vehicle is immobilized. However, that is not
the
standard anymore.
I'm sorry. I may not be following. In your brief, so what you're arguing is that there's an alternative basis?
Yes.
Is that what you argued in your brief?
It is mentioned in a footnote in my brief as an alternative argument. My primary argument here is that the warrant is fine.
Is supported by probable cause.
Yes. I just began with
your
this.
Your footnote 10 is what you're talking about.
Correct. And I just began with that point because that seemed to be a natural starting point.
Thank you.
And the last point I'll make with that is State versus Pedersen Maxwell, which is at 619 Northwest 2nd, 777. It's an opinion from this court. It's cited in my brief. And that talks about even if a vehicle is immobilized, the automobile exception still continues to apply as long as the search is done within a reasonable amount of time. And here the search was done, you know, we would suggest within a reasonable amount of time. The traffic stop was at about 6:30. The warrant was obtained, and then the search was done at 8 p.m.
So just spend a second on this, and I want to get to the probable cause for the
Absolutely.
Warrant.
Absolutely.
I think the response to that is, okay, that might be true in cases where there was not an exhaustive search. But if there was an exhaustive search of the vehicle, you still need probable cause, and probable cause is dissipated because there's no longer reason to believe that you'll find evidence following an exhaustive search.
Yes.
So that alternative basis still swings around to the issue of, well, was there an exhaustive search? No?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
I think the one reason potentially why the alternative basis is significant is if we are analyzing it just within the four corners of the warrant itself, while the state believes there is sufficient information in there explaining that it was not an exhaustive search, and I think it's also common sense that you can't do an exhaustive search on the roadside, there is also, if we're relying on a warrant exception, then we can look at the testimony from the omnibus hearing. And there is clear testimony from the officers at the omnibus hearing that this was not an exhaustive search. And he explains why they didn't do an exhaustive search. He explains how it's particularly dangerous for officers to crawl underneath. And yes, the squad video shows them kind of looking underneath, but they don't crawl underneath. You can't disassemble a vehicle. It would be hard, frankly, to do things like removing the headrest to take the sewing off, which is ultimately where the methamphetamine was found in that case.
I see. So it expands our record to look at. So if we switch
correct.
Then to looking at probable cause and the warrant itself, it
yes.
strikes when I'm looking at it, the application says that they conducted a vehicle search. That's in there.
Correct.
There was an alert and conducted a vehicle search. Then later it says, we want permission to do a more detailed search. And then it says at the end, roadside search. They want currently where a roadside search may not find them. If this were, we're going to leave aside vehicle exception, et cetera, just as this is a house.
Sure.
Okay, if the application said, you know, here's, you know, our evidence of wrongdoing, what we think, you know, the criminal issue is, and then says we conducted a house search. We want permission to conduct a more detailed house search. Let's just stop there. Would that be enough to get a warrant to do a second search of a house, just to say we want to do a more detailed one?
If it was self-evident from the first warrant that this was not an exhaustive search.
Okay.
In other words, if the first warrant sort of limited it to what you could do during that first search, I think that would be enough, you know, if it was self-evident.
Right. So it seems to me that what's self-evident really comes down to roadside search, that phrase.
Correct.
That you need to infer from that what a roadside search. Do you agree with me on that or not?
Yes.
Okay, because there's no other description of what was performed during the search or more importantly, what was not performed, right?
Correct. And so what they describe is a roadside search, and I think the common understanding of a roadside search, and it does mention, it identifies the road and the time of day, so we do know it is a busy road during rush hour, and I think what is evident from that is when we're talking about a roadside search in that circumstances, we're talking about looking in the interior of the car, maybe looking in the glove compartment, on the seats, under the seats, but it's clear that they're not talking about dismantling the car. They're not talking about those sort of, you know, particularly detailed searches that you can only do at, you know, a secure location or a location off the roadway. And that's why at the end of the warrant application, the officer describes, you know, due to the substantial probable cause that we have in this case, we are asking for permission to search the vehicle for illegal drugs currently hidden where a roadside search may not find them. And that, again, that's further indication that a roadside search is really just looking in the interior, the trunk, those sorts of things.
The hidden adds an element, you're saying.
Correct. Correct. And we also have to keep in mind here, we are talking about a person, and this is in the four corners of the warrant, the confidential informant who had provided reliable information, firsthand information that officers had corroborated, indicated that the appellant drove to this farmhouse and would acquire 1 pound of methamphetamine every day or every couple of days. So we're talking about somebody who is transporting a substantial amount of drugs on a regular basis. So that's sort of further indication that he's probably not going to have it out in the open, that there's probably going to be well-hidden compartments. You know, there it may be under the hood. I mean, there's all sorts of places that a drug dealer or a drug distributor would want to hide that, you know, that level or that high amount and with the frequency of the transportation, that this is probably a vehicle that's designed in part to transport drugs. In addition, I think it's important to note that the issue here, you know, this is not a de novo review. We're asking, is there a substantial basis? And the Supreme Court has described that as a reviewing court should give great deference to the issuing judge's determination of probable cause. And that's, again, to further the interest in obtaining warrants in cases like this. So I think if this court were to do a de novo review, there is probable cause within the four corners of the document. But even setting aside that point, there absolutely is a substantial basis that we have probable cause in this case. So for that reason, the state would ask that this panel uphold the search warrant, uphold the decision of the district court on this point. And unless there are any other questions on this initial issue, I will briefly address.
Yeah, I do. And I'm going to ask the same question I asked.
Okay.
Oh,
right. And I apologize. I had the answer in my head, but I've now forgotten what the question was.
So the question is, it seems like this case is different than some of the other cases that are cited by both parties. It seems factually different from the Chambers case that you referred to earlier, as well as the Zanton and Fort case. Are you aware of any case law, published or unpublished, anywhere in the country, not even just in Minnesota, about where there's a situation where you first search is based on consent, not a warrant, but consent, and then a subsequent search that's essentially the same search, but that one is based on a search warrant?
I'm not aware of any cases identical to that fact situation. You know, again, in this case, I would dispute the characterization as of the roadside searches being essentially identical to the later search.
Well, just to be clear. To try to see if there are any drugs in the car, right?
Yes. I mean, the focus of the search was certainly identical, but the ability to conduct the search on the roadside, you know, for all the reasons that the officer testified to, was limited on the roadside. So frankly, the officers did what we would want them to do. They had the vehicle towed and they immediately went and got a warrant, had a neutral magistrate review these facts, and ultimately obtained the warrant, conducted the search, and found the drugs. And to address also that question about whether the first search is based on consent or whether there was a prior warrant, I think when we look at the Zanter case, which is the case appellant primarily relies upon, the Minnesota Supreme Court describes the rule as once the police have engaged in an exhaustive search of a particular place, they cannot expect to research that area at a later date without providing the issuing judge with new information sufficient to indicate the items sought but not found during the prior search will now be found. And I think what the Supreme Court is trying to say there is if you've already done a search, at that point, there's not going to be probable cause because you've already searched it. You know the item isn't there.
Right. It doesn't matter whether it was done pursuant to a warrant.
So, and I understand your Honor's points, but I tend to agree with Judge Smith here that the basis for the first search I don't believe is an issue here. Rather, what the issue is was that first search so exhaustive that it dissipates probable cause to do a subsequent search? And that's what happened in the Zanter case as to everything except the blood in the home, because that was the only new information. So I think as we look at this issue, you know, I don't think we should be parsing out, you know, what new information versus old information. I think we need to look at it.
Why not, though? Because the language that you quoted specifically says that the police cannot expect to research that area at a later date without providing the issuing judge with new information sufficient to indicate that item sought but not found during prior searches will not be found. I think that new information language is extremely relevant, particularly it's from the Supreme Court saying you can't issue a new warrant unless new information is provided. So my question to you is, what new information was provided from the first search to the application for a search warrant?
Well, and I didn't mean to imply that the new information language isn't important, but in order for this language to be applicable, there needs to have been an exhaustive search. There needs to have been the type of search that it was so exhaustive that because there was the initial search, there's no longer a fair probability that the contraband would be there.
Okay, let's assume for the sake of argument that the roadside search that went on for 20 minutes by three police officers was exhaustive. What new information is provided in the second search warrant?
The only additional information is these 18 phone calls or text messages that were made.
How is that even relevant to the search warrant?
Though? I mean, it could imply that he was concerned making arrangements. I mean, there are a number of inferences that can be drawn. But what this case really comes down to is that first search was not exhaustive. And, you know, appellant talks a lot about we need to look at the four corners of the search warrant, but then appellant kind of tends to try to have it both ways and says, but we also should look at the squad video and see what they actually did. But that claim was not before the district court. And I would submit if we're going to look at the squad video and analyze what the officers actually did, then we're going to also look at the omnibus testimony. And the officer was very clear in testifying that initial roadside search was not an exhaustive search. And he described...
Who makes that determination? I mean, you both argued, and I question whether that's the issue here or not, quite frankly, because I'm not sure I'm convinced that Zanter and Fort are the right analysis. But assuming it is, who decides exhaustive? That seems fact-specific. And Judge Thompson specifically, in the last full paragraph of his decision in the memo, talks about the busy highway, talks about the squad video showing numerous vehicles, and talks about the constraints of a roadside search. So is that his prerogative to make the determination then, assuming Zanter is the right analysis as to whether something's exhaustive or not? It's not necessary. It seems fact-specific to me, and we're not a fact-finding court.
The court, and if I may respond to the question, I see my time's out. The court did make specific findings, in my view, on that last page, that this was not an exhaustive search. And he was relying, again, on the officer's testimony, which was not simply conclusory testimony, oh, it wasn't an exhaustive search. He explained what the limitations on the search were, and he talked specifically about things he could not do on the side of the road. And the court made factual findings on that point, and there's no claim here of clear error, and there's no basis to find clear error in those factual findings. So,
but may I follow up? But that only goes to then your alternative argument, your footnote 10 argument.
I would agree, correct.
Okay, so with respect to the argument of, you know, your primary argument that the warrant application on all fours, that that you look only at that within the four corners, rather, that as exhaustiveness still is critical, right?
It's your, correct.
It's your best argument that roadside search was, by definition, not an exhaustive search, therefore you don't need new information.
Correct.
Okay. And then you aren't conceding the absence of new information because there's a phone calls, but your best argument.
No, but I mean, the correct argument is that this was not an exhaustive search and that is self-evident from the four corners of the search warrant, in part because the officer in the very last paragraph explains why he wants it.
Okay, so in part, you said right there, in answer to Judge Flory's question, a decision about whether it was an exhaustive search or not, or whether the warrant shows it, you need to...
It's that
paragraph that you would look at, that the district court can then... or the issuing magistrate says, that wasn't exhaustive. I can tell from the last paragraph it was not.
From that, as well as sort of the discussion of the roadside search, the location, the time of day. Okay. I think when you look at all of those facts taken together, it was clear to the issuing magistrate that this was not an exhaustive search, and therefore probable cause remained. With that, I would ask that this court affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I want to be crystal clear about what you can and cannot consider in this case. When you are looking to determine if there is probable cause, it is incumbent upon you, and precedent says that you must consider only what is in the search warrant application. You may not consider the testimony of the officer at the omnibus hearing.
It's a fair argument, then, that in terms of the exhaustiveness of the search, that needs to be, you would concede then, determined from the face of the warrant under this, and the video and so forth, that we shouldn't even consider.
Here's my argument about that. I understand that we have all relied upon the video that was introduced at the omnibus hearing to talk about the facts of the search and whatnot. If this was an exhaustive search, then they should have put in their warrant application. That is not there. What supports that is that video. If you do not consider that video, fine. What's not in the warrant application?
But why could we consider that video? What's your argument that we could consider testimony in evaluating the four corners of a search warrant?
I'm not saying that you could.
Okay.
But if you did, in fact, choose to view that video, what I'm saying is that that only supports the lack of information that is in that about the exhaustiveness of the search in the warrant application. The warrant application only contains one word that may go to the exhaustiveness, and that is the roadside word. You have to do a lot.
I think hidden helps.
It does. You have to do a lot of inferring. Mm-hmm. And inferring is not what this court is supposed to be doing. This court is supposed to be relying upon the facts submitted by the officers who are in the best position to know what happened, to give that information to the signing judge. That information was not provided by the officers. The
signing judge draw inferences?
Not based on what's given here.
I mean, theoretically. You're saying we can't.
Not here, yes.
Okay, it's just the nature of these facts that you're saying.
The actual issue, whether the signing judge had a substantial basis for concluding probable cause.
That's right, yes.
So
our argument is
we're not substituting our judgment for his. We might disagree with him, but if arguably he had a substantial basis, then we should defer to that based upon the preference for warrants. Isn't that accurate?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. And our argument today is there is not a substantial basis.
Okay.
It's a deficient warrant, a deficient application. I can't tell you what happened between the judge and the officers, but I can tell you that this warrant application does not meet the requirements of Zanter, Gates, everything else that we've cited in our brief. Are there any other questions from the panel? We would just ask for reversals, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel. It was very well briefed and very well argued, and we always appreciate that. We will be issuing an order within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you.